Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me clearly? At the back of the hall, too? Good. It's somewhat difficult to present a clear picture of meditation after the opening remarks, because meditation has become much too much of a science in this day and age, and far too little of what it really is. Meditation is neither an art nor a science. If there is an art about it at all, it is discovering what its purpose is, which also means what your purpose is. When the Buddha left home at the age of 29, he did so because, he said, he had to find enlightenment. And people at the present time say to me, we must find enlightenment. But most of them have theories as to what it is. They think it is being aware of your next door neighbor, or very much more aware of what is going on around you. And the Buddha himself had this as a problem. It was not until after his enlightenment that he discovered what he had really been looking for. And I can assure you it has nothing to do whatsoever with some of the remarks we have just heard. No disrespect whatsoever to the speaker intended. One has to be very careful of getting involved in anything that may in any way suggest hypnosis. After the Buddha's enlightenment, in the Udana scripture, he states, O monks, now I know there is an unborn, undying, uncreated. And if there were not an unborn, undying, uncreated, I would not have found enlightenment. When I was in the Far East, my teacher, who also had a number of people come to him thinking that meditation was a means of becoming more aware of themselves, becoming more competent at their jobs, this sort of thing. My teacher, being somewhat annoyed with one of these people, said, you should know that anyone who meditates runs the risk of being grabbed by the cosmic Buddha. This annoyed the person very much indeed, because you see, cosmic Buddhas and gods are not very popular at the present time. But the purpose of meditation, which is in fact an extraordinarily deep spiritual, prayerful experience, the purpose of meditation is to become one with the cosmic Buddha, or, if you like, to have an experience of God, to know of his existence, to know that he exists, and to become one with him. This is the purpose of meditation. The art of getting there is another matter. You cannot do it via science, because science is too curious. I have often told a story to my monks of two people who came to me when in the Far East, one a psychiatrist and the other a psychologist. I told them how to meditate. They sat down and looked at a wall, or rather the psychiatrist sat down and looked at the wall. He was eager. All right, is that all I do? Good. And he sat down. Psychologist said, why should I look at a wall? What will happen if I look at a wall? Well, some 10 years later, he is still asking what is going to happen if he looks at the wall. The psychiatrist had a full kendril. Sadly, he died this year, but it wasn't a sad death. Because 3 months after he started looking at that wall, one day, he bunched his fist up, smashed it into the wall, which of course was paper in Japan, and there was a very startled, unfortunate Japanese on the other side of it. And his comment was, "I feel good now." And he came back and has been teaching in LA until his death. So you see, science is not much use. What is necessary is a heart full of love, a strong desire to be reunited again with that which is truly one with you, with that which you were before you were born, and that which you knew before your education and your parents and your teachers told you you were a dreamer and useless and you ought to become normal like everybody else. Because that was the state of true oneness with the cosmic Buddha. So, there is not much point in doing meditation if you are scared of being grabbed by the cosmic Buddha. In fact, there is no point at all if you don't like the idea. Incidentally, I would warn you that atheists are not safe. In fact, they are anything but. You see, they think that their atheism will defend them. And they don't realize that when they are ripe for the plucking, the cosmic Buddha just picks them off because they've got no defenses up. The man who has the most problems is the man who suffers from dogmas and similar things in his head and is so busy running around with them that he can't see straight. So don't think that if you are a scientist and you're just doing this and you take notice of what I say and you don't query it, that you'll be safe simply because you're a scientist. You won't be. If you sit down and look at a wall and you don't get your mind in the way and you don't theorize, the cosmic Buddha will pick you off like a ripe plum. I have seen it done on a number of occasions. He's especially fond of psychological types who think they're safe. I think it's a challenge to him. Anyway, where did I get to? So what brings people to meditation? Primarily fear. Even if it's only fear of incompetence. But if they dig more deeply, they will find that that fear has a totally different basis. Most people come to meditation for a reason they will not even admit to themselves. Fear of life or fear of death. There are more people afraid of life, actually, than there are afraid of death. Death is something they're going to have to put up with sometime or other, but they've got to wake up every morning until then, and that's rough. However, meditation will teach you how to make a good death and how to look forward to every day of the week. Not to dread every day of the week, not to worry about what is going to go on, but to look forward to it. Because in so doing, you know that you are not alone. You know that you are part of the one great cosmic Buddha, and that within you there is that which is undying and uncreated. And that undying, uncreated, no matter what may happen to you from day to day to day, no matter what may happen, nothing can harm that undying, uncreated. Once you find this place, there is never a bad day, and there is no fear of death whatsoever. For death and birth are merely positions in time, a time when one takes on a new set of bones and flesh, and like an old car, these are put on the dump when they've had it, and the undying and the uncreated continue. And maybe you pick up a new set of bones and blood, I have no way of knowing. Perhaps I will, perhaps I won't. But having found the undying and the uncreated, there is not a problem. It doesn't matter to me whether I live again in this life or in another life, for I know that there is the undying, the uncreated. And that is the purpose of meditation, and the art of meditation is finding that place. And it has got nothing whatsoever to do with all the other things that we hear. Many of them may be useful adjuncts, but pure meditation must be done. Without pure meditation, there is just no way in which you can find this place. You can do your flower arranging, you can play your music, you can have your discussions, but without pure meditation, nothing will happen. You may make yourself feel a bit better for a short time. You may even go home feeling good after tomorrow. I gather today, according to the mayor, is not meditation day, so you can listen to me instead. However, after tomorrow, you can go home feeling good. And understand, of course. By the way, I appreciate his comments. It's nice to be recognized. However, unless you are willing to go the whole way to the cosmic Buddha, don't try meditation. If you are afraid of being grabbed by God, don't look at a wall. Above all, don't sit still. Definitely don't talk to any of my monks. Because, you know, they might just have got him in their pockets. And without your noticing, you'll have a collar around your neck. And maybe, you know, there's another problem after that. We have a disease up in Shasta. It's known as falling hair. So please be very careful whom you talk to when my lecture is over. Falling hair is a very bad disease. Somehow it never grows again. But something else does. Something exquisite, something very beautiful, something very gentle. It is a return, if you like, through the watertight door that most of us fit between our adulthood and our childhood. A return to the time when we were young, in spirit as well as in body. We will not again get a young body. I shall not again look like a 7-year-old, not at any rate this time around. But your mind, your spirit is eternal. And being eternal, there is no such thing as age. And if a spirit is ageless, there is perpetual youth. And there is perpetual spring. And that is the beauty that monks share together in a sangha. It is also the life that they share together, for theirs is one life, not many. And they get there via the art of meditation. I do not propose to tell you how it is actually done this morning. One of my disciples, Reverend Hari Orr Young, will be doing that this afternoon. He'll be showing you the exact methods that we use in Soto Zen, which, by the way, is the only one of the Mahayana schools of Buddhism that still contains many of the original Indian trays of meditation to be found at the time of the Buddha. All the other Mahayana schools have become somewhat more sophisticated. He will not be able to go into this fully this afternoon. That is the differences in the histories of the two. That's what I'm talking about. But he will be able to give you a full and comprehensive instruction in how to meditate in the Soto Zen way. The ability to die in peace means the ability to live in peace. It means the ability to go around day to day to day without fear that if somebody is an idiot on the freeway, what is going to happen to you? It is the certainty of knowing what is going to happen to you. Or if suddenly a relative is taken, it is the certainty of knowing what has happened to him without fear of what may have happened to him. One of the beauties of the cosmic Buddha is that he does not have a hell that he holds over us. We make our own hell. As every Buddhist knows who has even been close to death or been close to anyone who has ever died, at that moment, the only judging that is done by oneself. We blame ourselves for what we have done, and thus hide ourselves from the cosmic Buddha. And that is exactly why, at the present time, most of us do not recognize that we are already enlightened. Every one of us possesses enlightenment. Every one of us possesses the Buddha nature, or the spirit of Buddha, or as the Christians call it, the soul. I don't intend to go into the difference between soul and Buddha nature, as I'm sure some people would like me to, because I think it will waste your time. I do intend to point out, however, that the Buddha nature, which every one of us possesses, is only hidden from our view because of our own opinions of ourselves. Because we have done this, because we are female, or because we are male, or because of heaven alone knows what, we are separated from our true being. The art of meditation removes that separation so that we may again return to it and truly know it. And at the time of death, when the cosmic Buddha, or as I'm sure a lot of you have read Dr. Moody's books on life after life, the great light comes, which is full of love, or as some see the cosmic Buddha, or as others see Christ, for these are screens through which we may see God or the cosmic Buddha. When that moment comes, if we say, "But I have done," then yes, we will miss seeing him. And we will, in our own time, judge ourselves. And so we do not die in peace. But if we have, as a result of meditation, got this fear of what we are and what we have done out of the way, then at the moment of death, we can go boldly on and become one with the cosmic Buddha. These are all the fruits of meditation: peaceful death, peaceful life, awareness of our fellow beings as being part of the cosmic Buddha, even whilst you are having to dislike some of the things that they get up to. One of the things I have had to make very clear to my monks in Shasta is that the drunk at the gate who is requiring entrance possesses the Buddha nature. If you cannot receive him as if he were the cosmic Buddha in person, then you are unfit to be a monk. But that does not require you providing him with another bottle. There is a very great difference between recognizing a man's Buddha nature and encouraging that which covers it up. So do not expect, if you come to Shasta, to find monks who will indulge you simply because you have a Buddha nature. It is because they love your Buddha nature that they will not indulge you. There is a great difference between the two. You will hear, I am sure, during this conference, a lot of things that meditation can do for you. Certainly, if you can handle your emotions through meditation, which, by the way, is about the only way I know you can handle them, you will find that your actual physical body will be much better. But you do not go into meditation in order to improve your physical body. You go into meditation in order to become one with the cosmic Buddha. By accident, you happen to get a good body in return, therefore, unless you have, as a result of karma, received some chronic illness from years gone by, as I have, in which case you will finish it out in this lifetime, and that will be the end of it. Such is life. So you learn to accept. And so you learn to become at peace within yourself and with your fellow men. Emotions do damage to every organ of the body. Each emotion does damage to a different organ. One of the things you will learn if you study Soto Zen carefully is what emotions to avoid in order to avoid damage to certain organs. For example, fear can cause, in the end, kidney trouble, just as worry can cause ulcers. And so you can go through every organ of the body, knowing which one is damaged by which emotion, studying what you have done, finding out how you have done it and why, and avoiding it. But not because you want to have a healthy body, simply because you wish to return to the cosmic Buddha. And having done that, you have a beautiful, healthy body to give to him and to his work. What else will meditation do for you? If you get the art correct. Among other things, it will make you extraordinarily aware, aware of the safety of others and the care of others. I was somewhat appalled just now to notice someone whom I'm sure regards themselves as a serious meditator putting sticks of incense between the carpet and the wood. The incense burned right down to the wood. No one who is meditating completely properly would do so dangerous an act because of the danger of fire to other people. One of the beauties of meditation is that it does keep you on the ball. You are awake. You are alive. If meditation makes you, as in some cases I have discovered, so-called meditation seems to make you less efficient than you were when you started, then you are not meditating properly. If it does not make you a good 75% more efficient than you were, then you have gone into quietism, and that is not meditation. Quietism and meditation are two totally different things, and one should be very careful of the former. It looks good, it sounds good, it's beautifully artsy-craftsy, and it's terribly dangerous. And it's one of the few things that every great religion of the world, Christianity, Buddhism, Mohammedanism, all the great religions have successively condemned throughout the centuries, not because people are not trying to do a good job, but simply because it leads to irresponsibility. So the next thing that true meditation will do is make you into a very responsible person. It will not make you into a nuisance. It will not make you into a busybody. If it does, then you've gone wrong again. It does, however, make you aware of things like the possibility of fire, checking to make sure that the exit doors do work, and not obtrusively, but just making sure that they do, if there is a large gathering of people, because you see, I want every one of you to go back to the cosmic Buddha. I want every one of you to have the joy that I have got. And if you all die in a panic, you won't get that. That being so, since I am interested in it from that angle and from no other, I will check these things. And a true meditator will do everything in his power to make sure that the rest of the world around him is safe, just to be certain that everyone else can return peacefully to the cosmic Buddha. It doesn't look like much. It's not very spectacular. Just making sure that you drive properly on the freeway is a gift to your fellow human beings. Just making sure that you don't go charging across the road as a jaywalker is a gift to your fellow human beings. It is proof of good meditation. Wandering along, sort of looking hazy with a stick of incense in the air, is not good meditation, because some unfortunate wretch in a car is going to have to try and keep you alive. And that may be somewhat difficult if you don't give him some help. So do not get confused as to what meditation is. It has got nothing to do with external display. Now, I know that immediately somebody is going to say, then why have you turned up looking like this? Well, the answer is, because if I didn't, some of you wouldn't listen to me. Now, where did I get to again? Finish that one. Obviously, if you do meditate properly, you will have an advantage over everyone else who does not, and a responsibility to them, because you will be far more quiet and still and aware of what is going on and capable of handling situations than can those who do not meditate. And this responsibility to others is something that not everybody wants. So if you don't want to be responsible, don't meditate. Again, if you do not want to become a full adult, don't meditate. Because there's no way you can remain childish. You should know, I'm sure you do, know the difference between childish and childlike. A childlike person is a joy to know, and a childish one needs his ears boxed. Well, the childlike one is the one who has truly studied meditation and has got back to that beautiful state prior to having himself messed up by education and what other people thought he should be like. Whereas the childish one is the one who wants his own way, who thinks that every lane on the freeway belongs to him, who considers that everybody should like what he is doing, and has no consideration and no thought whatsoever for the other people around him. Beware of the latter. They may think that they are meditating. They are not. The signs of a true meditator are benevolence. Benevolence in the sense of wishing to help all living beings, of finding wise ways to help them that are not really spectacular, as I said, just making sure the exit doors work and that somebody's stick of incense doesn't burn the building down, are not exactly going to be spectacular. They are not going to get you awards from the city and state. But they may make it possible for someone to live long enough to find the cosmic Buddha. Therefore, benevolence comes under finding wise ways of helping beings without sticking your neck out and making yourself look terribly important. Beware of spiritual pride. Wise ways of helping beings. Love. Recognizing the Buddha nature in every living thing, no matter how repellent it may appear to some and occasionally to you. It's somewhat difficult, even for me at this stage, and that sounds terribly swollen-headed, to believe that everybody on occasion has the Buddha nature. But I work at it. After all, I am not a saint. I am just doing the best I can, and I'm telling you how it should be. Sympathy is the third sign of true meditation. Being able to feel for another person, being able to recognize the situation of another person, being able to place yourself in that situation, and therefore to understand it from his point of view. These four, benevolence, love or charity, sympathy, and the last, tenderness, are the four signs of enlightenment. They are the four signs of having become one with the cosmic Buddha. There are going to be no trumpets sounding to hail you as a great saint. But the world may be a little better for your having existed when you die. And your reward, a peaceful death, and a number of people who may follow in the same way. This is the art of meditation. It has got nothing to do with what can we find out scientifically, what can we find out in order to improve our art. It has solely to do with giving. Let me give. What can I give to the cosmic Buddha? How much can I give? Everything I have. Let me give everything I have. That is the purpose of meditation, and the art of it is being able to give in that way. Not to get rid of one's emotions in order to be able to avoid having stomach ulcers. Not to do one's meditation in order to feel better. Not to do it in order to get an important name in the world. But solely, what can I give? How much can I understand my fellow men? How close can I be to my fellow men? Not sitting there saying, let me look to the left and to the right and to the back and to the top and to the bottom and see who's there. It is just giving out love. And not worrying who's there. If I took the trouble to look who was to my left and right, I'd sometimes run. Be very careful of such means. Your purpose is to just love without criticizing, without thinking, without worrying. What would you do if you found, I don't know, demons are out of fashion these days. Supposing you found an alligator sitting on the chair next door. How would you feel about it? Could you recognize the Buddha nature in it? I know that's an impossible and a stupid statement, but the fact remains that if you do this, you do run the risk of the mind getting in the way, thinking getting in the way, cognizance, thoughts, and immediately you have thoughts, you have a problem. Because then you start debating about these things. Are they good? Are they bad? Just don't worry about it. Just do it. Don't bother to have anything in between. Just do it. That's all that matters, the doing. Not the looking about and the studying. It's the doing that gets on and does it. And that's atrocious grammar. I got about a quarter of an hour left. Anybody want to ask any questions? This is your last chance. I'm only speaking at this one. Yes. Could you repeat that? I couldn't hear you. On the quietism, yes. The main problem with quietism is that it can look uncommonly like real meditation. The way in which you can tell whether it is true meditation or not is that it is the results that come from it. For example, if a person is saying, I can't possibly do this or that because I must do my meditation, the danger is that he is going into quietism. It is, there is meditation over here, and there is this thing over here, which is a confounded nuisance, and this is going to disturb my quietness, my peace. In other words, in quietism, self gets in the way. There is his meditation, his time for meditation, and there is that other thing, which is a nuisance. Because true meditation and service to mankind are synonymous. There can be no difference between the two. And after one has learned to meditate, and one does not need to take all that much time if one is really serious at it, after one has learned to meditate, the main thing is to learn to put it into practice. If you don't put it into practice, it will become selfish in a very short time. And as soon as it becomes selfish, it will become what is known as quietism. And that is its big danger, becoming selfish. I have said to many people who have said to me, oh, I have sat six sessions, that is full-length week retreats, or 20 sessions, and I've been beaten 600 times, and it was, and they've expected me to say how marvelous they are, and I've said, huh? And they've looked very disappointed, and perhaps they've walked away. But somebody who comes to me and says, I don't always manage to get half an hour of meditation a morning, but I always manage to get 5 minutes, and who also then tells me, maybe, it's amazing, I've discovered that the boss and I can get along. I know that man's meditating. He's really put the thing into practice. He's not playing games with it. He has done his 5 minutes or his half an hour, and then he's gone off refreshed, and he's been able to see the boss in a totally different light from what he did. He's discovered, in other words, he was human, because he has begun to discover that the boss possesses a Buddha nature too, and that the boss has to die, and that the boss has fears just as he has. And once you can do that, once you can become one in true sympathy with another being, their meditation has truly been established. Yes. Sympathy, tenderness, love, and benevolence. All one point. And they're all the signs of enlightenment. Tenderness. Being able to feel for one's fellow beings. Being able to give up what one wants to do in order to help them. Being able to recognize that when somebody has got something up the spout, he's got it up the spout, and not trying to tell him that he's crazy for it. Trying to say, right, this is where you are at the moment. Maybe at a later date you will be in a different place. In other words, understanding him, trying to know, trying to understand, without trying to judge. It's incredibly difficult at times, especially if one has a good brain and one is a bit, and the person one is dealing with one would normally regard as dumb. But that again is the art of meditation, learning to recognize that other people do have problems and that one does have to try and help them. And as I said, one has to recognize that everything that comes to the temple door has the Buddha nature, however difficult it may be to do that. Tenderness is a beautiful thing. It is willing to save the whole world before one saves oneself. It is the willingness to give up everything that one wants for oneself in order just to help one other person. The famous story of Dogen Zenji, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, who had a monastery full of monks, and one of them was a kleptomaniac. And the rest of the monks were getting thoroughly fed up with this. And they all went to him in a body in the end and said, "All right, if you don't throw this idiot out, we're all leaving." So he said, "That's fine. You don't need me, and he does. Goodbye." And they all looked very worried and stayed, because he had given them a magnificent lesson in tenderness. Who needs the priest but the one who is in real need? The rest were doing marvelously. They didn't need him. They knew how to train. But the other one didn't. And just think of what it would have done, supposing they'd all decided to go, but he trained them too well, so they didn't. But that's neither here nor there. But just imagine what would have happened if they had. He would have been broke and starving, and who would have agreed with what he had done? Having compassion, having leniency towards evildoers, is one of the signs of tenderness. It is also one of the signs of benevolence. It's very difficult in this day and age understanding this type of mind, especially when the current temperament of the times is to treat evildoers far more harshly than we have been doing in past years. I am in no way saying that wrongdoers should be allowed to go unpunished. Do not misunderstand me. I am saying we should get the vindictiveness out of it. There is a tremendous difference between rehabilitating someone and being vindictive about it. And that is the meaning of tenderness and benevolence. It is doing something constructive rather than destructive, no matter what a person may have done. Yes? I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Not if it's real. What usually passes for love is an emotion, but that's a very different matter. True love has no emotion whatsoever. It just is. It is the stuff of the universe, the stuff that makes us all tick. Have you ever thought what a marvelous love the cosmic Buddha must have to put up with some of us? There was a line from a film that I remember once. Only a God that could possibly tolerate you could possibly tolerate me. And there's an awfully good line. Just think of it. There is no emotion there. But that is what real love is. It is seeing the potential, seeing the real, rather than seeing the external. Forgive me, I can't hear you again. Emotion, jealousy, fear, worry. The question was, what do I regard as emotion? And the answer is jealousy, fear, worry, grief, reactions to situations that cause us to lie. These things are emotions. These are all things that we can train ourselves out of. And of course, they lead to much more serious things, such as vindictiveness and malice. That is emotion. Yes? Please, could you, the noise of the air conditioning is too much. One of the problems of translating books
The question was, some of the pictures of mandalas, etc., were really horrible. How could you find love and the light within them? And the answer is that, of course, a lot of people who have translated books have not had such a good knowledge of the language as they might. And in addition to that, you have to remember who such mandalas were written for or painted for. Just as in the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church, for example, created demons and hobgoblins and heaven knows what else to keep the people who were uneducated from getting out of line. So the Buddhist Church did the same thing, so don't worry about it. Everybody had to go through that phase sometime or other. The danger comes if you can't see beyond it. Don't worry about them. Yes, go ahead. No. It makes you one of the most warm, one of the most... Sure. I was asked, does Zen make you cold and emotionless? And the answer is definitely no. It will make you one of the most warm, alive, and vibrant people in the world. It will make you so overflowing with love that everyone will want to be near you. Everyone will be after you if you're young enough to get hitched to, and don't meditate for that purpose. You see, it's not one of these cold fish things. This is another one of the problems of people who have been to the East for a very short time and have come back, and they write these lovely little poems about moons and stars and flowers, and they have not ever got right down to the real depth of the thing. They have not got to the cosmic Buddha. They have got to what he shows. They've mistaken the finger pointing at the moon for the moon itself. The flower and the moon and the star are the signs of the cosmic Buddha. But it is to know the cosmic Buddha that releases the fountain of love. And that is the thing that you have to get to. Not the cold, starry attitude of mind that I have bumped into from time to time. I've got time for just one more. Yes. Yes, what you are saying is there is something that is a sort of emotional love that is distinguishable from the real thing. Unfortunately, from the Zen point of view, that comes under an emotion and comes out as something that is a grasping love rather than a giving love. A true love, from the point of view of Zen, gives all and in return gets everything, but it doesn't give in order to get. The real danger of the emotional type of love is that when the giving from the other party is over, there is nothing there and the two people part. And that is the emotional version. Where is it? Good. That thing got fast during the night. Yes. Would you repeat that? I can't hear. Could somebody repeat? Oh, what's the basic differences between Christianity and Buddhism? Because I sound like a Christian. Well, that makes me rather pleased. Because, you see, the basic differences between Christianity and Buddhism, there is no savior in Buddhism. You're going to have to do it all for yourself. All the troubles that you've got yourself into, all the consequences of what you have done, you are going to take. There is no one that is going to take those consequences for you. As a result of what you have done, I would appreciate if you didn't do that when I'm talking, it's a little difficult. all the consequences of what one has done are the result. Are you? Flesh bulbs do that to me. All the consequences of what you have done, you are going to have to take for yourself with no assistance from anyone else. You are not going to have someone to whom you will eventually go who will mediate for you as a result of what you've done. You will go to the cosmic Buddha at the time of death with all your good and evil karma. And if you have not taken the trouble to do something about yourself in this life, then you will at the time of death judge yourself. That is the first big difference. The next big difference is that the cosmic Buddha, that which is XYZ, God, Lord of the house, whatever you like to call it, and I don't really care, does not and will never judge you. That which is that which is. It just simply is. It is not its problem that you are good or bad. It is your problem because you have created the mess. Therefore, you have to clean it up. It has nothing to do with you in that sense. It is not a God the Creator in the sense that it is not a father with a big stick standing in some nebulous place to slug you every time you do wrong. You get the slugging from your own activity and then complain about it. If you ask me, how does the creation, as in the Bible, fit in with Buddhist teaching? The answer is that I can only tell you what the official answer is of the Buddhist Church, because I don't know. To my knowledge, I wasn't there at the time of creation, but maybe I was. Who knows? The answer is, I can give you the official information, which is Buddhism goes along completely with Darwin's theory of evolution. Yes. How can you let go of the mind in meditation? Very simple. Do it. That's too simple an answer. There are two ways, there are two things you need to do. First of all, you need to know that there is such a thing as deliberate thought and accidental thought. Deliberate thought is deliberately thinking. Accidental thought is that which arises by accident. Now, I know I sound as though I'm repeating myself, but there's a good reason for it. Accidental thought. Here is an example. Someone is sitting in meditation and a car goes by and a dog barks. And you notice that the car goes by and the dog barks. Deliberate meditation is, I wish that car hadn't gone by. That's disturbed me. Confound that dog. You see, your eyes are not closed completely in true meditation, and your ears are not stuffed up. So you are going to notice the pattern on the carpet, and you are going to hear the car going by, and they're only going to disturb you if you allow them to, if you chase after them. I've often likened true meditation to sitting under a bridge that goes over the top of which goes a freeway. Now, you sit under there and you're looking at the river and the cars are rushing about on top of the bridge, and you can climb up onto the bridge and hitch a lift if you want, the cars being your thoughts, or you can go on sitting under there and just noticing that they're coming and going. Do you see what I'm saying? Just don't get caught up in it. Just sit there and let it happen. It's only going to disturb you if you chase after it. I can remember asking this very same question of my teacher in the Far East. And he said, well, this morning, under my robe, a flea was walking. Just I noticed it had strong legs. Think of what else he could have done with that, and you'll see how to drop off mind very easily. That's the only way you can do it. You have to start that way. And in the Fukan Zazenge, which is the explanation of how to do meditation, they have two distinct words. It's frequently translated as think the unthinkable or something equally crazy, but what it comes down to really is don't try to think and don't try not to think. Just sit. And in Japanese, it comes out as no deliberate thought, accidental thought, so it happens. Which means very simply, just don't get caught up. Yes. Go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I think it's very good to meditate with a group. I think it's excellent to meditate with a group. But do remember that there are pulls with that. There are disadvantages and advantages both ways. The advantage of having a group means that you've got people who can encourage you. It also means that you've got people who can lead you astray. The advantage of being alone is that you don't always feel guilty if you miss going to the meditation hall. One of the problems of belonging to a group is that the rest of them can make you feel awfully guilty if you don't turn up. And sometimes people do have schedules that they just cannot always turn up. So there are distinct advantages both ways. You really have to decide what your schedules are like and who the people are you're meditating with. Try it from that angle. I can't give you a better answer than that. Unless you're all literally living in a place together as a monastery, in which case that's the best situation possible. Yes. You may ask through any screen whatsoever. The question was, would a Christian perhaps ask Jesus to help a fellow being? The beauty of the cosmic Buddha is he's willing to answer to any name, including atheism. That's one of the things that really annoys him. He doesn't mind what title you give him. He will answer to it. And if a Christian wishes to do it saying, I am asking through Jesus, the cosmic Buddha will oblige. Just by loving them like mad, even when he's swearing about him for cutting him off on the freeway. You have still got to maintain this incredible love. Just give it out. You see, even when you are doing it through Jesus, what do you think you're doing? You're giving them a good wish, shall we say, at the bottom, at the lowest grade possible. You are asking Jesus to help them, but that is your wish to help that causes that to happen. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you didn't want them to be better, you wouldn't ask Jesus to make them better. Oh, what do I do then? I sit still. If I'm really mad, I sit still. I sit very still, and I put my brain in gear, because if I don't, I could make a very serious mistake. And then by sitting still, I find it goes very fast, and I can love immediately and forgive. You really have, that's something you learn from meditation. That's an art you learn how to do. And Buddhists have people that make them mad too. Never do anything in a hurry is one of the most important of Buddhist teachings. Just be very still before you do something. Yes. I've been asked this question many times before. Does it matter what form of meditation a person chooses to do? I would certainly say that if you've got a form that you prefer to another, do it. I personally think mine is the best way, but that's reasonable, otherwise I wouldn't do it. However, the fact remains that the Buddha himself said, all paths lead to the goal. Walk whichever one is best for you. If you've found one that is good for you, then please, by all means, use it. If you haven't, I still think mine's the best way. Fair enough? Yes, go ahead. Trial and error. I started off in Theravada Buddhism, and I worked through that. I worked through it primarily because of its dislike of females. I'd already worked through Christianity because of its dislike of females, and I got to Theravada, and it was somewhat better, but still there. And I then went to Rinzai Zen, which went a lot further. And by the time I was in Rinzai Zen, it no longer really mattered very much what people thought about females. And then I found the more deeper form of Zen, which is the oldest school of all, which is Soto. And I found what I was looking for. So you see, by starting off from a very unworthy reason, why the heck have men got to reserve seats in heaven, I ended up by finding what I was looking for. So you see how even the cosmic Buddha can transcend the most unworthy motives. It's the only way. You see, we do have to go into this from the point of view of the me side. What is there in it for me? That's what everybody goes into religion for. They're scared out of their wits. So what is there in this one for me? Can I find more peace than I have now? Or else because we're mad about something, which is really a form of fear. And so you steadily work through. And finally, if you're really sincere, that sort of idiocy that brought you in, and yet it wasn't idiocy because it was very serious at the time, that sort of thing drops away and it no longer matters. And you find what you're really looking for in the first place and discover you already had it, which is very beautiful. So that's what I recommend you to do. Take a look at them, find which one is true for you, and go ahead. But do be careful of any that requires you to keep your eyes tight shut. That is a somewhat dangerous thing, especially if you are the sort of person who can visualize or has a vivid imagination. Yes?
I'm wondering if it's part of the plan to keep fumbling around by using
until you find the right one. Yes, I would say, yeah, oh yes, I would say that. Definitely it is important that people search around until they find the one that is right for them. And it is part of the process that we do fumble. And I fumbled from about the age of 7 when I decided that what I was being fed wasn't true to the age of 39. That's a heck of a long time. Half of you aren't that age yet. Yes, if sometimes visions do occur, if you have your eyes tightly closed, you can skip off into the vision because it's so much more pleasant than everyday life. If you have them partially open, you retain your grasp on reality. Contrary to what people think, visions frequently do occur. They don't do any harm to you whatsoever unless you mistake them for what is real, or if you go off into them saying, I love this, why come back to the real world? Do you understand what I'm saying? You can hypnotize yourself into liking it too much, which is reasonable considering what sometimes the real world is like. But that is a very dangerous situation to get into. And if you're meditating properly and you do have a fairly vivid imagination, visions are going to occur. also some other things are going to happen. Everyone has to go through this to a certain extent. You may hear things, you may see things, you may feel things. None of these things are going to harm you in any way. They are to be learned from, and they're very valuable. But don't grab them, don't run after them. And the danger of keeping your eyes closed is that you've increased that possibility 100%. You keep them only partially open, just a little open. You find a suitable spot on the floor where, if supposing you're sitting on the floor, you look for a suitable spot where your eyes will be comfortable and just let them rest there so that the lids are very much lowered. Just keeps you nicely in touch with reality. Okay, it would seem I have... all right, we'll take one more. There's two more. Okay, I'll take both of you. Let's have you first. I'm sorry, I can't hear you again. I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. What?
Are you anti-scientific?
Not anti-scientific at all. I just don't want people to think that science, the scientific results that come from meditation, are its only results. You can't do meditation just to study science. What I'm warning is that any scientist who tries this, the cosmic Buddha is going to sit there with a big grin and pick him off. So don't think that that's all it is. Okay? Right, you have one. What is my definition of reality, the real world? Being one with the cosmic Buddha and knowing that that is the normal state to which every being in this world has been called. The Christians say, many are called, but few chosen. And the Buddhist says, all are called and few answer. Fair enough. Thank you, friends. I have enjoyed being with you.